Tonight we're talking about imparting ministry skills, and tomorrow night we're talking about imparting character. Now, these subjects overlap, and so what I'm going to try to do is stick to one area of imparting ministry skills tonight, namely that of communicating the gospel, ministry skills as it relates to the non-Christian. And then tomorrow night, as we talk about imparting character, we'll get into the area of building disciples. And so we'll get into something on the how-to and the building of disciples tomorrow night in that subject. So it's such a broad topic when you talk about imparting ministry skills. What kind of ministry? You take the whole spectrum. And so we'll have to narrow it down. What we'll talk about then is imparting ministry skills to in the area of reaching people. And that's kind of the thing that I'm concerned about nowadays, reaching people, because I see that there are so few Christians that know anything about communicating with the world. And so I'm glad for the opportunity to talk about this tonight. I'd like to start out maybe by giving a little bit of my own personal odyssey of how I came to learn what I do know about reaching people, which isn't very much. And I'll tell you about my failures, because I learned a lot more about from my failures than I did from my successes. I'll never forget the first time I saw the wheel illustration. You know what the wheel illustration is? You know, we navigators have these funny little illustrations that we hang everything on. How many of you have seen the wheel illustration? Okay, well, that's good. We're on the same frequency. Well, the wheel, you know, has the hub and the four spokes and then the rim, and it's used to depict the six basic principles of the Christian life. And I'd been a Christian already for a while, and I ran into this navigator, and he started showing me what I needed to learn, and he was using the wheel illustration to show me. And I liked the first point, you know, the hub, Christ the center, you know, Holy Spirit in my life, in my relationship with dependence on Him. I could really groove on that. And then he drew the first spoke, the Word. I thought, man, that's good. I really want to get to know the Scriptures. And then he drew the next one in, you know, prayer. And I thought, yeah, I'm for that. And then I began to get suspicious. I thought, oh, there are four spokes. I know what that fourth one's going to be. And he drew, and, you know, at that time, it was back in the olden days, and the third spoke was obedience. And so he drew that in there. Now it's fellowship, which is better, by the way. And sure enough, when he got that fourth book, it was what I was afraid it was going to be. Witnessing. And I thought, oh, punt. You know? That is not my deal. Not my bag to go around and tell my friends and people, you know, about Christ. Because I just had some hang-ups on that, that's all. And I thought, well, I'll be a three-spoke Christian. No sweat. So I set out to be the best three-spoke Christian in the world. And I loved to study the Bible, and I was studying the Bible like mad, and you know, I was praying and having fellowship with God, and trying to apply it, and so on, live the Christian life. But you know, it began to bug me. And for some unexplainable, completely incomprehensible reason, I began to want to talk to people about Christ. And I was married at the time, going to the University of Minnesota. I remember I would sit there studying, and I couldn't get my mind on my books, and it was just driving me up the wall, the fact that I wasn't talking to anybody about Christ, and I had this mad desire to do that. And I remember that several times I would sit there sitting with my books open, I'd slam them shut, put them on the table, and get up and get in my car. My wife would watch me leave, you know, and I'd get up and get in my car and drive over to the University of Minnesota, over to Kauffman Union. And there they had this huge lounge. And, of course, my intentions were obvious. I was going over to talk to people about Christ. And I'd be praying like mad all the way over there, you know, just kind of keeping one eye open to watch the road and praying the rest of the way and saying, oh, Lord, you know, when I get there, I want you to have somebody there and so on and so on and so on and so on. And I'll never forget Kauffman Union. The scene is indelible on my mind. They had these huge round pillars right at the entrance of the lounge there, and high ceiling, about four-story ceiling, and then a lot of lounge chairs and stuff around. And so I'd walk in there, it'd be maybe 8 or 9 at night, and I'd look around and look for somebody, you know, had a newspaper up in front of him, you know, with his legs crossed, and he was obviously not doing anything important. I thought, well, now there's the man I'm going to talk to. And so I'd head for him, and I'd stop and think, well, but I better pray first. And so I'd duck behind one of those huge round pillars, and I'd pray. Then I'd say, now I'm going to go talk to him. And I'd come up from around that behind that pillar, and I'd think, well, I'm not so sure I've prayed enough. And I'd go duck behind the pillar again. And you know, I'll bet you I went over to that place a half a dozen times and never talked to a soul. And I was so frustrated and so defeated that I just thought, well, I'm gonna go be a farmer. You know, I just, you know, people are not my bag. So, one day I made the mistake of telling Ed Rice, the guy who was helping me, about my problem. I didn't tell him in specifics. I didn't tell him, you know, that I'd been going over and talking, trying to talk to people and totally flaming out. But I just told him that I had some problems in that area. And so he said, well, I can help you with that someday, maybe. I said, sure, that'd be a good idea. And he said, when? And so I whipped out my success diary. I was already squared away, you know. And I whipped out my success diary, and I says, well, now let's see. I tell you, Ed, I'm really pretty busy. Let's see. You know, I could have done it the next day, you know, but I tried to prolong it. So I says, well, let's see. I think 2 weeks from Thursday I can make it. And I swear, I marked it 2 weeks for 2 weeks later. We were going to get together and go out and do some evangelism. So there it was in my success diary, the date we were going to go and talk to people about Christ. You know, man, I sweated. It was like waiting for the dentist, you know. I prayed, you know, that something would happen, that I would die, or that the rapture would come, or, you know, just anything. I just was afraid for that day to come. But lo and behold, it came, and we got in the car, and we headed down to Northfield, Minnesota, which is a town about an hour away from Minneapolis. And I don't know why we went there, but there are two colleges there. And we parked right up in front of the student union. And I'll never forget the scene as long as I live. There's a huge curved sidewalk that ran around the front of that student union. And as we parked the car, a guy came out of the door and started walking up the curved sidewalk. And I thought, well, you know, at least for now we're safe. He's not going to talk to that guy. And so we got out of the car and started walking around that curved sidewalk. And lo and behold, Ed stopped and started talking to this guy. Well, I was just mortified. You know, I stood off, you know, like I was bird watching or something, and act like I'd never seen Ed before in my life, and just kind of, you know, standing over there like this. I swear, this is what happened. I'm not exaggerating. And so, you know, so Ed stood there and talked to him, and I was just, you know, totally indifferent, you know, just totally casual, sweating it inside. And finally he got done with him, and we went on in. We went into a little coffee shop, down a few stairs into a coffee shop, and got 2 cups of coffee and walked over to a table. There were 4 guys sitting there, and I got my half a cup over to the table. And we sat down, and lo and behold, old Ed started talking to these 4 guys. And I was sitting there. I couldn't get any, I couldn't move. You know, I had to sit there and watch it, see? And lo and behold, those guys, they didn't stone him. Or, you know, even laugh at him. They listened. And I thought, man, that was kind of a cool way to get into it and so on. You know, the way he moved into the subject. And pretty soon I was quite intrigued. Well, we talked to him for a while and shoved off. Went and talked to some other guys. We spent the whole afternoon doing that. And little by little I began to gain courage, gain steam. Until, boy, by the end of the day, man, I was just, you know, chewing nails. We got back into the car. It was getting dark. Got back into the car and started away from the campus, and there were 2 hitchhikers standing on the corner. And so I stopped, Ed. You know, so we stopped, and those guys got in the back seat. And, boy, they hadn't even sat down. I was just on them, you know. And, boy, I gave them Genesis to Revelation, you know, and just the whole 9 yards in that trip from Northfield to Minneapolis. And we pulled into Minneapolis and stopped for a stoplight, the first stoplight, and the guy says, we get out here. So, boy, they got out and off they went, but I didn't care because I had broken the sound barrier. And, man, that really made a difference. We didn't have any results that day. It's kind of like Jesus in Mark chapter 6, where he sent them out two by two. And it doesn't say much about the results, but it says when they came back, they reported into Jesus in verse 30. And it says they reported into Jesus, and they told him everything that they had done and taught. And what it was a training situation. And he wasn't so concerned, I don't think, about what they did, what they accomplished, as he was what they learned. Probably when they came back, you know, Jesus says, well, how'd it go, fellas? Oh, John says, you know, man, that's, I don't know if that's for me. That's kind of scary, just coming up to some guy you never laid eyes on before and talking to him. And so Jesus had to, you know, encourage John a little bit and say, look, John, you know, I'm with you and I've given you all authority and all power. Yeah, I know that. Well, just stick with it, John. Peter, how'd it go? Oh, great, chief. Any problems? No. Well, one guy began to give me some lip. Well, what did you do? Well, I just knocked him off the dock. You know. Peter, you just, you know, and so he had to kind of coach him, and that's the way it goes when you start out. You know, you don't do anything right, but that doesn't matter. You're doing something for the first time in your life. You know, I think I should have gone to seminary. I never did, and you can see it, I think. Sorry. Well, the next day, when I got back to Northfield, the next day, I had lunch with Pete Colas. I always had lunch with Pete Colas and a few other guys. Pete Colas was about this tall and about this wide. He was a little weightlifter. And just a little monster. Really buddies. And I told him about Christ. And you know what happened? Pete Colas became a Christian. Man, I could not believe it. I said, Pete, you really became a Christian? He says, yeah. You really did? Yeah. No kidding. So I went running to the telephone. I dialed Ed's number. And I said, Ed, Pete became a Christian. And I told him about it. I was so excited. I think I was more excited about that than I was when my daughter was born. My first child. I really swear I think I was. Because that's how hungry I was. And so I began then, after doing this thing down in Northfield, which didn't produce zilch, you know, then I began to work with my friends and tell them about Christ. And man, things began to happen. I began to lead my buddies to Christ. And I got some and some I didn't. I remember one guy, Dewey Johnson. He was in one of my art classes, and really a cool guy. We used to fish together down on the Mississippi River. And one time went fishing. I thought, no, I'm going to get him. So I went fishing, and afterwards we sat there cleaning fish. And I said, Dewey, are you a Christian? And he says, no. And so I said, well, man, you ought to become a Christian, Dewey. And so I told him about it. We sat there cleaning fish, and I told him all about how to become a Christian and everything. And when I got through, he says, you'd be a good missionary. And I says, well, are you going to become a Christian? He says, no. And that ended our friendship. That ended it. You know, we didn't do anything together after that. He was scared of me. Some you win, some you lose. But you know what happened? It wasn't long, 6 months, and I'd run through all my friends. You know, that either signed up or checked out, one of the two. And there I was. Didn't have anybody to talk to anymore that hadn't voted one way or the other. And so what did I have to do? Well, I had to go back to, you know, this is what I understood at the time. I had to go back to doing the cold turkey thing. You know, knocking on doors of people you never laid eyes on before in your life. And so I began to do that. And so I picked up a few little tricks, like a questionnaire. I kept a little page in my notebook, my success diary of tricky openers, you know, how to get into the subject. Anytime I'd hear somebody with an opener or something, I'd write it down. So I was collecting openers. And so I'd, you know, be casually talking about sports or something, and I'd drop in one of those openers, you know, trying to be casual, and it was like dropping a bomb in a conversation. It just blew the conversation. But that's all I knew how to do. And I learned how to present the bridge and a few other things. And so I'd go around and do evangelism. And I'd get some decisions and some results. Never forget this one guy, a sailor. And I was just going through the barracks at Will Chamberlain Field and talked to him about Christ, and boy, the guy was interested. And so I said, well, come on over, let's talk about it some more. So he came over the next day. We spent 3 or 4 hours at our house, and I talked to him about Christ. And man, he's got, you know, tears all over the place, and he made a decision. He left, and I thought, well, you know, angels are singing now because this guy just entered the kingdom. And that was the last I saw of him. I spent the next 2 weeks trying to track him down, and he'd see me coming, and he'd duck and hide and try to avoid me. And that kind of evangelism, it's good for the evangelist. He learns a lot of things, but it's not much good for the evangelized. He doesn't, you know, you don't get much permanent results out of that. But I'm not saying don't do it. Because if I hadn't done it that way, I wouldn't be reaching people today. I think that's the place to start. But don't think that you're going to spend the rest of your life doing that, because it's not going to pay off. I'd say when you're in college, do everything that comes to your mind that looks like it could reach somebody. Because every experience that you can have, any experiment that you can run, anything you can try, no matter how wild it is going to teach you something. And that's how you learn to do something right, is doing something wrong. Or just doing something. So that was about the state I was in when I went down to Brazil, as far as knowing how to reach people. Now, I'm not going to tell you what the process of how I came to learn to do it a little bit differently, but because that would be awfully lengthy. What I'd like to do is explain to you, maybe summarize what I've learned about reaching people, and we could label it three-dimensional witness, or evangelism after 30. You know, most of you are going to spend 90% of your life on the other side of 30. You know, most of you are in your 20s now, and the rest of your life will be, you know, from there on in your 30s. So this applies to you. This is not going to help you very much on campus. It will, but and it'll certainly work on campus, and you'll bear fruit on campus using this. But it's something that you want to remember all your life. Starts out this way. There it is. Okay, three-dimensional witness. The first witness that you, and this is related, fellas, to the thing we're talking about this morning, is the witness of your life. And what we found was that presenting the gospel to somebody who has not been prepared by a Christian heritage, or who is not, you know, emotionally and intellectually and as far as his own will is concerned, prepared to respond to Christ, you do not reach him. He does not become a Christian when you just present the gospel one time or twice or so. It's a process. And you do not communicate it just with words, but you communicate it with your life. You know, so often in our ministry, we treat people as projects or as objects, rather than as people. And so we have a program of evangelism. And so we get people into the program. And we have a successful project when we've got lots of them there. And there's something a little bit diabolical about that. Because in business, you use money as your criteria of progress and success in your enterprise. But in the Christian ministry, we use people. Well-meaning people. And sometimes the last thing a person needs is to be a part of that program that you've got. Maybe his family's falling apart. Or maybe he has other problems that he needs to attend to. But to be faithful to the program, he's got to leave those things behind and show his faithfulness by being there and being involved. When you've got your program, we can use people in our evangelism, in our Christian ministry. Or we treat people as objects. You know, like you get up in the morning and You guys who are married, you know, you can treat your wife like a clean shirt supplier and a breakfast fixer. And she treats you like a child discipliner and a money dispenser. And you get in your car and you drive down the road and you stop at a gas station. And there's a fellow there, and you treat him like a gas pumper. If there was a machine there, it could do it just as well, but there's a person. And so we go on and we treat people like objects all the time. And we can do that in the ministry, too. I remember when I was beginning to evangelize, I wasn't so concerned about what was happening to the person as I was about whether I was witnessing or not. And I remember I had a house full of guys, a nav home, back in Minneapolis. And I'd come home real cool-like, and I'd say, "I witnessed today." "Oh, gee, did you?" "Yeah, you know." And I'd tell them all about it. And I'd get a few more stripes on my sleeve when I'd come in and say, "I led a guy to Christ today." Well, the emphasis wasn't on that person. Where was the emphasis? I was glorifying myself and using people as objects for my desire to be a successful witness. But what we learned is that you have got to expose your life if you're really going to reach people. You've got to let people into your life. And the verse that we talked about this morning, in 1 Corinthians 15:34, let's add that to this illustration. 1 Corinthians 15:34, where Paul says, "Awake to righteousness and stop sinning. For some have not the knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame." Or Jesus said in Matthew 5:16, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your lifestyle and glorify the Father which is in heaven." Now, one thing that this presupposes is that we let people into our lives and then we expose ourselves to the world. And I think this is the place where we Christians really have a problem. And part of it comes from our misinterpretation of the Scriptures. Because we take the verse, "Wherefore come out from among them and be ye separate," as being, "Wherefore come out from among them and be ye isolated." And so a nice Christian person doesn't have any truly pagan friends. And so he has to go to people he's never laid eyes on before, if he's going to talk to somebody about Christ, because he doesn't have anybody around him. He's not intimate with anybody who is of the world. And in fact, we think it's bad if we are. But Jesus prayed in John 17, "I pray not that you'll take them out of the world, but that you'll keep them from the evil one." He says, "As you sent me into the world, Father, even so send I them into the world." You see, we don't need the world. You know, I could get along just fine without the world. All my problems, sin would be over if I didn't have the world around me. I'm here not because I need the world, but the world needs me. And I have got to learn to be able to be in the world and in the thick of the world without getting contaminated. That's the trick. And one of the reasons that we do not have communication with the world is because of this thing of our isolationist mentality. The world out there is dirty. Let's stay away from it. And then when the world comes around us, they're afraid of us. They look at us and they think, "Ooh, he's a reformer." And they don't want to fall into our hands because they fear that we're going to start reforming them. And when they get close to us, their fears are confirmed because indeed we do try to reform them. We let them know that we don't really approve of the way they smell, or what they put in their mouths, or the way they spend their time, or their moral standards. One way or another, they get the message all the time that somehow or other, we just do not approve of them. And they feel judged in our presence. And there's no need at all for that. We've got to learn how to totally accept the person who is deep in sin and make him feel totally comfortable around us. Jesus managed to do that, and he was perfect. But because certain habits and certain things offend us, we start cleaning the person up before we're willing to really get involved and work with him. But you know that everything that a guy does, you know, whether he's on, you know, whether he's an alcoholic, or whether he's dropping acid, or whether he's going to bed with his girlfriend, no matter what he's doing, they're only symptoms. And no skillful doctor treats symptoms. He only goes after the root cause. And the root cause of all of these things is sin, which is the man is alienated from God. He needs to be related to Jesus Christ. And so we let all of these things go by, accept the person totally so that we can get at the real cause, which is his alienation. We've got to learn how to let people into our lives. You know, I told you that I went through all my friends in about 6 months. And then I had to go knocking on doors. And the reason I had to do this, and this is very normal, you get a job, and you run up your flag in the first 3 months, everybody knows you're a Christian, everybody kind of takes a position about you, and that's it. You spend the next 40 years looking at the same faces. And you think, well, there's no opportunities to witness around here, same bods every day, I don't know what I'm going to do. And the reason that I ran into this dilemma was because I had not run into Luke chapter 14. Let's take a look at that. Luke chapter 14. This is an incredible chapter. Because here, Jesus is at somebody's house as a guest. And you know that when you're at somebody's house as a guest, you're supposed to be in your good behavior? Jesus wasn't. And he had something to say to just about everybody that was there, and not a whole lot of it was really very nice. And especially to your host, you're supposed to be polite. But look what Jesus said to his host. Verse 12. He went on to say to the one who had invited him, his host, when you give a luncheon or a dinner, as you are doing right now, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, like you have around you now. But invite, because they'll just invite you in return. So your lifetime is spent, it's a stoner's turn to come over to our house. Well, let's see, we went over to their house last time. And so we run this, let's have them over, okay? Because it was their turn last time, so on and so on and so on. So we spend our whole lives running this check and balance thing on our friends. And so, when the day comes, when we, end it here, we're even Steven. Nobody owes anybody anything. And that's a social custom of the day. But he says, now don't invite those kind of people, because they'll just have you back. And that turns into a vicious circle. Do you think you can obey this passage of Scripture? When you give a reception, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. Now, when Jesus talks about the poor and the crippled and the lame and the blind, he's talking about the unregenerate, the person who is Satan's captive. He's not talking about a person who can't walk or he can't see or he doesn't have any money. He's talking about a person who is Satan's captive. And so what he's saying is use your table. Invite people into your life. Go out of your way, and this is the key, go out of your way to continually open your life to people who you would otherwise normally not get involved with. And that is something we need to constantly work at all of our lives, is that there should be in our lives a flow of people that come in and out because we take the initiative to become friends and draw them in. Now, it's not enough just to say hello to them on the street and talk to them out there. That doesn't do any good at all. They have got to come in to your life, to your family. You know why? Because it's the Christian's lifestyle that is the message. See, in the universities, the open nerve, many times it isn't anymore, but it was a little few years ago. I don't know what the open nerve is now. Maybe there isn't any. But the open nerve was the existential questions. Who am I? What am I here for? What's the meaning to it all? And so there were questions of meaning that were bugging the university student. But then he graduates, and he steps into the real world, and he cannot afford the luxury of asking those kind of questions anymore, because he's married a woman, he's gotten a job with a corporation, and it's trying to consume him. It not doesn't want his 40 hours a week, it wants 80 plus his soul, and his wife wants the same equal time. And then they beget children, and you know, things turn into hell on earth. And so he's asking questions of survival. How do I get along with this woman under my roof? How do I defend myself how do we defend ourselves from these little monsters we have begotten? How do I put it all together? He's just trying to figure out how to survive. And when he finds a Christian, you know, clothed and in his right mind in this mad, mad world, he says, how come? But he can't see that just as you walk by, because you bought your suit from the same place he did. You don't look any different out there. He's got to come in and see you. Mario Nietzsche has the work in the city of Curitiba, the place where we began it all in Brazil. It took Mario 4 years to become a Christian. And during those 4 years, we studied the Bible weekly, hour after hour. When I met Mario, he was the head of a communist cell group. And he was so burned on religion that we couldn't use terms like God, Jesus, sin, the blood, the cross, any word that had religious connotation when we studied the Bible. Now, you try studying the Bible without using any of those words. Well, we just, changed the words around a little bit, like, God, in Portuguese is Deus, which is four letters. In English, it's three, G-O-D, so we just changed it to one, X. And so we began to study about X. Because if we'd use the other words, you just see the color rise, and he'd just get livid. And, he'd block out. You wouldn't communicate anymore. So we started studying. And I discovered that the guy is really an intellectual. He wears glasses that look like Coke bottle bottoms. And he has a bookcase about the size of that one, about the same height, maybe not quite as high, one shelf lower. But it's crammed with stuff by Marx, Engels, Freud, Camus, Sartre, Rousseau, Hegel, the whole deal. Everything that built the Western civilization, he has it, he has read it, and has synthesized it into a coherent philosophy. And he was a humanist. Well, so there was Mario and me studying in the book of Romans about X. And we just have at it. And the discussions were always very intellectual and very stimulating. I enjoyed them immensely, even though there was blood and hair on the walls when we were through. But little by little, without his perceiving it, he began to believe in X. But his communist cell mates perceived it, and they expelled him. And he left in a rage. And then he joined a terrorist group. And the terrorist group used a mountaineering club as their front, and so they could carry on their operations, training and things, under the guise of doing mountaineering, and actually they were preparing for some terrorist activities. Well, Marty made the mistake of inviting me along one time, and they called him the next day and expelled him, and it was just an act of God, because a month later, the police, the government came in and closed them down, locked up a bunch of them, tortured some of them, and some of them got away. Well, so Marty and I just continued to study the Bible through all of this. We went at it for 4 years. And something similar to what happened to my sister happened to Marty, where his world just caved in. There was just nothing left. He was in dentistry, and he was in his last year, and, everything just caved in on him. And in a rage, just the kind of guy he is, in a rage, one night, he'd been laying there tossing, not sleeping, his sheets were in knots. He says, okay, God, I give up. Now get off my back. And that was his conversion. That's how he became a Christian. Well, we're reminiscing. Maud and I are great buddies. And we're reminiscing, about a year ago now. And he says, Jim, you know what brought me to Christ? And I thought, yeah, 9,000 hours of Bible study. And he says, no, about 2 years after we began to study, he says, I came over to your house one time for a meal. We were just kind of on our way in and out, and I stopped in. That was the first time I saw your family. He says, I was engaged to a girl at the time, and she was a witch. You know, she wasn't in the occult. She was just the witchy type, see? And he says, I was going to marry her, because I just thought that I'd never seen any marriage that wasn't like that. I just thought that anybody married a woman married a witch. And so I figured that, you know, one's as good as another. But then he says, I saw there at your house, he says, your kids were cutting up. And he said, I saw how Marge, my wife, related to the kids, how she handled them, and how you related to her and she to you, and so on. I saw the relationships there. And I sat there and I asked myself, Mario, when are you going to have a relationship with your fiancée like that? And he says, I realized, never. And so he says, I realized then that I had to become a Christian for my own survival's sake. You see what I'm getting at? The guy that looks like he's super intellectual, that he's off on a cause, and that he's just impervious to the gospel, inside he's running scared, trying to figure out how to survive. And which means that we need to make sure that we are surviving. And as survivors, let's let people see that survival is possible. And so that's why I say that the first witness is the life. We let people into our lives. The second witness, we find in John chapter 17, verse 21, but it's the witness of the body. The witness of the body. In John 17:21, Jesus, of course, is talking to his Father here, and he says that all may be one, even as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be in us, that the world may believe that thou didst send me. Now, Francis Schaeffer makes a very interesting observation on this last phrase in this verse. And what he says is this, this phrase says that God, or that Christ is saying that the world has the right to decide whether Jesus was divine or not. The divinity of Christ can be judged by how we Christians relate to each other, if we love each other or not. And in John 13, 34 and 35, we have the same thing, where it says, by this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one for another. And so the next thing that happens to this person who has been exposed to your life is that he asks a question. He says, I wonder if there are any more like him, or if he's just a fluke. And so he begins to watch, and he begins to try to find out what makes you tick, what kind of people you run with. And you'll find that once you've made friends with a person here, that what he'll do is he'll begin to drop broad hints. He'd like to find out, you know, what kind of people you run with, what makes you tick. Now, I'm not saying here, now it's time to bring him to church. That's not what I'm saying. That comes later. And depends on how far the person is out. It may come quite a bit later. Because you can't get the world into the church. It won't fit. But you can always put the church in the world. And what we're after is not to get everybody in those four walls, but it's to get everybody into the kingdom of God. And the way to do that is to find a few kindred spirits and say, okay, let's go hunt. You open your life to some of your friends, I'll open my life to some of my friends, and we'll just start to put it together. And a new little fellowship will grow up, made up of people that would never darken the doors of a church or respond to a conventional approach in evangelism. We stumbled onto this. Actually, everything I'm talking about, we just stumbled into it. We weren't that smart. It just, you know, God led us. We had a bunch of new Christians, and they were so new that they didn't know how to do anything themselves. So we thought, well, let's give them a little bit of help. Let's help them reach their buddies. So one of their biggest problems was just getting over the hump and really getting into Bible study with the guys. They could kind of witness to them, and they could tell them, you know, that they were in the Bible and that they were Christians and so on. But that wasn't enough to, you know, push these guys into the kingdom, because they're just a long ways out. Well, we came up with the idea of having open Bible studies. And the way we would operate would be 15 guys or so. Each one would invite one or two friends that he had been already kind of jacking with on the subject. Well, then, one of the fellows would be picked, the person who has the gift for that kind of thing, would be chosen to take about 20 minutes to make a little presentation on some aspect of Christianity, like the nature of man, or who is Jesus Christ, or what is the Christian message, or some facet of Christianity. And he'd make about a 20-minute presentation, then just throw it open for discussion. And we usually have this on a time, you know, when the guys they're all available, like, you know, some night during the week, or on Sunday morning, or on a Saturday night, or something like that. And so they'd come over, and we'd have this discussion, and the discussion would last an hour or something like that. And then afterwards, they'd just kind of break up, and they'd drink some coffee and get the guitars out and play samba music for a couple of hours and show off by noon. Well, we began to observe something, that nobody that entered that group to attend an open study ever left there without eventually becoming a Christian. We were getting them all. And we couldn't figure it out. I thought, man, the content isn't that good. You know, these guys, we wouldn't even jump in and help them when they get dangled with a question. And we wouldn't let them answer the question on a philosophical level. It was always, you know, use the scriptures. And so, boy, the guys really got nailed many, many times in the discussions. They'd lost the discussions many times. But still, all these guys were coming to Christ. And look, we had guys, 80% of them were Marxists. You know, they were not pushovers. And a lot of the people that would come would be, they'd come with the understanding that they would be the devil's advocate. That's something we always just invited, a guy who was really rabid. And we'd say, now look, we want you to come. We know that you're, you know, this is your position. We know that you're an atheist. And that's the reason we want you, because we want to polarize the situation. And the guy says, well, if I come, I'll blow the thing up. Fine, that's what we want you for. Okay, I'm warning you. And he would live up to his word. But you see what happens when you have a guy like that in your crowd is, you know, he'll be making radical statements. And here are the guys in the middle who don't believe either. But here's this radical over there. And some will say, yeah, I'm with him. But the majority will say, man, he's too radical. So they come your way. And so you get the majority, and then you pick off the stragglers, and you got them all. Well, but then I discovered that the guys would believe, making the same observation all the time. They'd say, man, I've never seen guys like that before in my life. They'd all say that. I've never seen people like that before in my life. Then one day, Osvaldo came up to me. This is one of the key guys there in town. And he said, you know, Jimmy, he says, I'm not going to bring anybody to these open studies anymore. I said, well, why not? And he said, well, he says, I think it's cheating. The guys don't have a chance when they come. And he says, I kind of think it's kind of a crutch for me, because, you know, the guys come and, you know, they're in the basket. They had seen that this one guy was not a freak, but there were all kinds just like him. And there was a relationship among them that they were just envious of. And so they would just fall into the net because of they were seeing the gospel. By this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one for another. And the thing is, we didn't know that that was going on. And if you try to make it go on, if you try to fake it, you're going to blow it. You've got to be yourself. But, and we look at ourselves and think, man, we're so imperfect. If we had non-Christians around us, you know, they'd be scared off. But, you know, that's not true. And I'd like to make one other comment here. We think that we have to be good testimonies by being careful to abstain from a list of things and being careful to observe the list of do's and don'ts. That is not what being a good testimony is. Being a good testimony is the way you live. The relationship that you have with your buddies. The way you run your life, whether it's in order or not, whether you've got it put together or not. That's what being a good testimony is. That's what being light is. And let's keep that straight. Well, then what happens? After we've received the witness of the life, the witness of the body, one more witness has to take place, and without it, there's no deal. And that is the verbal. Nobody comes to Christ just by watching the life or by seeing the body. There's got to be an explanation. And in 1 Peter 3:15, Peter says, be ready to give an answer to everyone that asks you a reason of the hope that is in you with meekness and fear. Now, you think, yeah, that verse has bothered me ever since I ran into it, because nobody ever asked me. You know, if I had to wait around for somebody to ask me before I tell them, you know, I'd wait till the rapture and I still wouldn't have talked to anybody, because I haven't, you know, I don't have, who's going to ask me? Well, if that's true, one of two things is probably the case. There are probably more things that could be the case, but I just want to mention two here now. One is that you're just not exposing your life to people. You're not letting people in. And your concept of reaching people is to go out there and knock on the door and shout John 3:16 at them and jump back into your fortress and say, I did it. See, nobody's going to ask you anything if that's the way you operate. You got to be in there among them. You got to smell like they do. And then they're going to start asking you. But they'll start asking you and you won't pick up the question at first, because it'll come disguised. Like I was with this one guy, Lauri, he's a brother-in-law of one of our key fellows in Brazil. And went over to his house, and he was working very hard on a bottle of scotch. And so we got to talking, and the guy's, you know, way out there as far as the gospel's concerned. Lawyer, and, you know, very cool athlete. Just one of these guys that acts like he's got the world by the tail. Beautiful wife, beautiful home, everything. So he said, well, let's go downtown. So we went downtown to a place of dubious reputation. And we sat there, and he picked up another bottle of scotch and was working very hard on that one. And pretty soon, he was ready to talk. And that's what he'd been doing all night. And so finally, you know, he was ready, and he leaned over, you know, nose to nose, and he says, my life is a mess. And I looked at him, you know, nose to nose. And I says, yeah. And then he began to unload. Well, why was he telling me that his life was a mess? Why was he telling me that nothing he was doing meant anything? Why was he telling me that he had this beautiful house and it didn't mean that much to him? He had everything, he'd accomplished everything. Why was he telling me? Because he saw that maybe I could help him. It was a scream for help. But see, it's so easy to sit there and pray that God will give you an opening to witness to him when he's sitting there screaming for you to witness to him. Another approach is a guy will ridicule you. I used to ridicule guys before I was a Christian. You know why I would ridicule people? Because I was trying to get some information. And I was too chicken to come out and ask them. So I would push guys until I thought maybe if I push them far enough, they'd defend themselves, and I could get some information. And so the guys that ridicule you the most are probably the guys with the hungriest. That's the 1 Peter 3:15 question, when a guy's ridiculing you. Or somebody comes along and says, man, I can't get along with my wife. Why is he telling you? Because he thinks that maybe you've got it figured out. But so often what we do when the 1 Peter 3:15 type question comes along is we just kind of pass it off and say, well, I was lucky. Or, I had good bringing up. And we don't take the opportunity of the lifetime and relate what he's talking about to the gospel. And the reason that we don't is because we don't understand the gospel in those terms. If they took away eternal life from our sales pitch, we wouldn't have anything to say. Because we haven't learned that it's our relationship with Christ which makes our lives a coherent thing. You know that C.S. Lewis was a Christian, had been a Christian for a year before he discovered that there was eternal life in on the deal. I think that's beautiful. Because however he got the message, it came across that he saw that it was something that he needed right now for this life. We need to learn to communicate in those terms. Let me illustrate how this works. I was on a plane flying back to Brazil, and I'd been up in the States for about 2 months, a series of conferences and stuff. And it's summer down there, and it's winter up here, and I'd caught cold, and I was all plugged up. Then you fly, and you go up and down, and everything that's in your head goes out into your ears, and so you're deaf. And it's just, you're miserable. And I was peopled out. I had it up to here. And so I changed planes in Atlanta, and I was flying down to Fort Lauderdale, where my wife's family lives, and then I was going to stay overnight and then fly on down to Brazil. Well, I got on the plane, I sat in the aisle seat, and then there was an empty seat there, and there was a 24-year-old girl next to the window. And so, just so that nobody would bother me, I had this book up, and I was reading it. And, I had it as close to my face as possible, as businesslike as possible, just reading away in that book. Maxwell Maltz, Psycho-Cybernetics. Well, we weren't even off the ground, and this 24-year-old girl leaned over, and she says, what are you reading? And I said, a book. And she says, what's it about? Psycho-Cybernetics. And she says, oh, do you study psychology? Nope. And on we went. Well, we got off the ground, and she was just, firing questions, and I was deaf, and she's hollering, and I was leaning over. So I slid over and sat next to her, and she carried on the conversation. And it didn't take long to realize that she was just in a flirting mood. Well, I've learned that the best defense is a good offense in those situations. And so I began to tell her about my wife and kids. And I told her, I says, I travel a lot, and sometimes I get tired and very lonesome, and it's a desolate thing. And I says, there are a lot of temptations to be unfaithful to my wife. But I says, I won't. And I says, the reason is because she has a blind confidence in me. And I have a blind confidence in her. And I have learned it's that mutual confidence that makes our relationship what it is. And I said, I could cheat on her, and she'd never know it. And I could come home and act like nothing had happened. And she'd give me that blind confidence, and I'd feel like a rat. And consciously or subconsciously, I'd have to start tearing that blind confidence down and just get it off of me because I knew I didn't deserve it anymore. And pretty soon, the two of us would be alienated. And my kids, what would that leave them? So I went on and explained to her, why I just don't run around with women. And she sat there like someone had hit her in the solar plexus, just kind of looking at me. And she says, I've never heard anything like that in my life. And then she began to open up and tell me about her situation. She said, you know, I'm afraid to get married, she said. I run around in a crowd there in Fort Lauderdale, and she says, whenever one of the wives, the husbands, one of the wives leaves, the husbands are there at my door. And she says, for me to marry somebody, she says, I know that he's going to be the same way. He's going to be just like a little boy. And she says, I'm scared stiff. And she says, where did you get this? I said, well, you'd laugh if I told you. She says, no, I wouldn't. I said, I got it from the Bible. You see, it's important not to chapter and verse people when they come to you with a problem. But it's also important to make sure that the counsel you give them, and this is why I'm telling you this story, make sure that the counsel you give them comes out of the Bible, and that your lifestyle is explainable in biblical terms. See, I was talking about leaven the other day. See, if there's any leaven in your life, then your life becomes incoherent, your message becomes garbled, and you don't communicate schmutz. Well, I went on and I explained to her what it is to be a Christian. And about that time, we were landing in Fort Lauderdale. And I thought, nuts, I didn't get a chance to, tell her the whole story. So the plane stopped up at the ramp, and I got up and let her pass, like a gentleman should. And then I let some other people pass, because my in-laws would be out there waiting for me, and I didn't want them to see me walking off the plane with this gal. And so I was walking up the ramp, and lo and behold, somebody grabbed me by the arm. And it was this gal. And she introduced me to her friends, those same friends that she'd been worrying about on the plane. And I stood there for 10 minutes while she described our conversation. And I walked away with a lump in my throat. Because I knew that if I could just have a few days, I could help those people come from darkness to light. Just a little sequel on the story. A year later, I was back in town, and I was in Kennedy's church there in Fort Lauderdale. And lo and behold, in walked this gal and sat down right in front of me. And after the service, she got up, and I turned to her, and I said, hey, I know you. And she says, yeah. She says, we talked on the plane. She says, I'll never forget that conversation. It changed my life. And I think that God just let me see, the end result of it. Well, see, the point is this, that when you let somebody into your life, and when you begin to explain the gospel to them, it should be based on the explanation of why you are the way you are. It should be related to their needs, their life. Now, that's a lifelong enterprise, to learn to communicate the gospel that way. But it's worth it. Well, let's summarize, and then we'll quit. We talked about three witnesses. Witness of the life, witness of the body, and the verbal witness. Now, the subject is imparting ministry skills. What do we need to learn to carry on this kind of ministry? And you can see that this is something you can do when you're 40, 50, 60 years old. This is something you can do all your lifetime. Because you'll always have a circle of friends. You can always relate to them. You can always open your life. And you can always do a better job of communicating the gospel. So what do you need? Well, for now, you need all the experience you can get. Just do anything that comes to your mind. Knock on doors. Pass out tracts. Hold big deals. Do anything you can think of. Because it'll all help you, I swear. But then, in the midst of it, learn how to put a sinner at ease. You see, when we come into contact with a non-Christian, we have a choice. One of the two of us is going to have to be uncomfortable. Either he or us. Now, according to the Bible, we are the ones that are supposed to be uncomfortable. We are the ones that are supposed to adapt to him rather than the other way around. And so the second point is learn how to relate to the non-Christian. Learn how to put him at ease. And learn how to feel at ease with non-Christian people around you. The third is always make sure that you have a band of a few kindred spirits around you that will work with you, co-labor with you in this kind of a ministry. And you're sort of an outpost of the church. Always out there doing something the church could never do. And that's your job. That's your responsibility. Because you are the church. And this is the job that the church is called on to do in the Scriptures. And then the fourth is to be sure and give your lives to integrating your lifestyles with the Scriptures. Make sure that your lives are really consistent with what the Bible teaches. And then learn how to articulate that. And then you're ready to reach people.